It's the day before the presidential elections in Afghanistan, and violence is breaking out. But will the danger keep voters at home? It hasn't in the past.
We have seen people show up in large numbers, men and women, registering for elections. And we have every reason to believe that they will show up in the elections day, and incidents like this will not deter them.
That's Afghan presidential spokesman Humayun Hamidzadeh saying Afghans will turn out to vote. With less than 24 hours to go, we are waiting and watching on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, August 19th. John Hockenberry is away. I'm Lynn Scherr here with Amy Holmes. Morning, Amy.
Good morning. Great to be with you. Coming up this hour, we're going to be talking about a new study that shows that it's possible to fake DNA evidence. So CSI crime writers, get your pencils out. Also, tomatoes in peril. When you go to the grocery store, you might see that supplies are down. But you know what? We have tips for you to survive a tomato-free kitchen.
But first, we're here with BBC correspondent Lise Doucette from Kabul, Afghanistan. At least tomorrow, Afghans go to the polls. No one expects it will go off without violence. Will the Taliban be able to disrupt the election?
Well, they're already creating fears, not just in Kabul, but across the country with their attacks. We had three attacks in Kabul yesterday. There was an attack of some kind this morning, a robbery of a bank that was also blamed on the insurgents. And that's the big question. It will be not just the actual violence on the day, but the fears of violence that will keep people from voting.
Any indication whether people will in fact stay home, or is there a sense of defiance?
We shouldn't underestimate Afghans. They have survived a generation of conflict and hardship. We saw how in 2004, 2005, they defied Taliban threats, warlord intimidation. They turned out in incredibly large numbers to exercise the simple, basic right to vote. The big question this time is, will they think it's worth it?
Thanks, Lise. Stay with us. We will finish our conversation in just a moment. But first, everything else you need to know this morning.
In the headlines, Hurricane Bill is now a Category 4 storm. It's gaining strength well out in the Atlantic. Forecasters predict wave swells and strong currents along the U.S. East Coast. Hurricane Bill could threaten Bermuda later this week. Two key House Democrats want health insurers to hand over records. Congressman Henry Waxman and Bart Stupak say they're investigating executive pay and business practices at dozens of the largest insurers. They want the documents by next month. Companies don't have to hand them over just yet, but lawmakers could force them by subpoena.
President Obama takes his health care pitch to the pews. He's talking to religious leaders about his plans via conference call. More than 1,000 faith leaders are expected to take part, largely their supporters of the president's ideas. And two North Korean diplomats will meet with New Mexico Governor Bill Richardson today. The governor's office stresses he is not negotiating on behalf of the Obama administration. Richardson, of course, was U.N. ambassador during the Clinton administration and has met with North Korean officials over the years. Forbes magazine releases its list of the 100 most powerful women in the world later today. So, who do you think belongs on that list? And do we actually still need a separate list of female moguls? Tell us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
I'm Lynn Scherr here with Amy Holmes today. Afghans go to the polls tomorrow, and the violence has already begun. The Taliban yesterday struck at the heart of the capital, Kabul, with suicide bombings and a rocket assault at the presidential palace. We talked just moments ago with BBC correspondent Lise Doucette from Kabul. I asked Lise what the feeling on the ground today was in Kabul.
Well, you join me on a bright summer, sunny day here in Kabul, and the streets are incredibly quiet. This is Independence Day, so it's a national holiday. You'd still expect the streets to be choked with traffic, and some Afghan friends with their distinctive Afghan humor said, well, it seems like the streets of Taliban days when Afghans couldn't afford cars because there aren't many cars on the streets. But there is a dark side to that joke, and that is that many people are fearful after the attacks of yesterday. There was even some violence this morning. A bank was robbed, and it was also blamed on the insurgency. So I think people are being very cautious and very careful before tomorrow's big day.
Do the people, in fact, know about the violence? I know that there was a ban by the government on news organizations from reporting that violence. So how's the word getting out?
This is a country where, for all of the imperfections of Afghan democracy and the things that haven't happened in the nearly 8 years since the Taliban fell, that has a very lively media. There's more than a dozen radio and television networks here. There's a lot of Afghan newspapers. And of course, there's all the foreign media, too. This is a country very much connected to what's happening in their district and what's happening in the capital as well. So they do hear about the violence and they do know what's happening in the run-up to the polls. Maybe they don't know all of the details, but they're certainly very aware of the big developments, if you like. So they would know and they would take the precautions necessary.
And are you anticipating putting any reins on yourself because of that government ruling?
No. There's part of, you know, the international community says they're here to promote Afghan democracy and freedom of the press is part of it. And even though the government, as you say, is trying to impose restrictions, we're here to report the elections as we see them. BBC also has a Persian television and radio network. We also have a Pashto radio network. So we've got BBC colleagues right across this country and they're going to be reporting from dawn to dusk.
Tell me how security is being stepped up, please.
You walk down the streets of Kabul and at every corner there are police checking the cars. You go out onto the main roads. There are also Afghan army soldiers.
And I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there for now. Lise Doucette, BBC correspondent, joined us from Kabul, Afghanistan. And Amy, over to you with more on the elections.
All right, Lynn, and we're moving from the BBC perspective to a military perspective with retired General Anthony Zinni. He led U.S. Central Command until 2000 and was a high-profile critic of the Iraq invasion, I'm sure you remember. He has a new book out about leadership called Leading the Charge, Leadership Lessons from the Battlefield to the Boardroom. Welcome, General.
Good to be with you, Amy.
Elections are tomorrow in Afghanistan. How crucial is it that the Afghans turn out to vote?
I think it's critical that these elections go well. It would be a signal of increasing stability and the influence of the current government to control things. Should it go badly, I think it will set back considerably faith in the government and faith in the stabilization operations that we're conducting.
Now, there are literally dozens of candidates running against the current president, Hamid Karzai, but his main challenger is his own former foreign minister, Abdullah Abdullah. What would it mean for U.S. forces and our fight against the Taliban if Abdullah Abdullah became president?
Well, I've met Abdullah Abdullah and had some long conversations with him. He's a very impressive individual. I think whichever way this goes, it wouldn't affect our operations there and how we do business. In many ways, I think either candidate is going to have basically the same approach as it concerns us and our involvement and our cooperation with the government.
General Zinni, what do you think about reports of our forces meeting with so-called moderate Taliban leaders in order to try to quell the violence?
From my time out in this region, in Pakistan and the area, there seems to be a consensus that there are some reconcilable Taliban, that's the term they use, that all Taliban are not the same. Their motivations may be different, and the reasons that they oppose us vary and are different. And so if there are incentives and if there are agreements that can be reached that certainly lessen the number of enemy we face, I'm all for that. Going back to my time in Vietnam, we certainly had worked with the Viet Cong who had defected or were willing to defect and had some programs of engaging them and actually turning some of them around to working with our military forces.
General Zinni, it's interesting that you bring up Vietnam because a lot of people characterize that war as having become a quagmire. How will we know if we're succeeding in Afghanistan? What, you know, the buzzword are metrics. How do we measure it?
I think there's several ways. If you look at the objectives of the administration's strategy, one, they want to internationalize this, meaning share the burden. We need to see more boots on the ground that are not just U.S. and willing to take on combat missions outside just the Brits, the Canadians, and a few others. We need to see more regional cooperation. If we could begin to see the Pakistanis and Afghans and even Indians beginning to coordinate and work together, we'll probably have to pull that together. I think the other metric is going to be the number of Afghan security forces, military and police, that we're able to put out there that are effective, And are able to accompany our soldiers and Marines on their operations. This last operation with thousands of Marines, we just had a few hundred Afghan security forces. Obviously, that's got to change. And so those are the kinds of things I'd look for. And on top of that, the ability of the Kabul government to reach out, be effective, and influence things outside the capital city.
So, General Zinni, how long do you think we have to see success?
I think, the longest pole in the tent is going to be the development of the Afghan security forces. And this is just my view, but I think it's going to take 3 years to really have them in a position where they start standing up and taking hard missions,
Do you think President Obama has 3 years to show the American people success in Afghanistan?
I think it's critically important that he pay attention to American will and the ability to stay with this. He needs to constantly assure the American people of why we're there, what we're doing, what the objectives are. We're 8 years away from 9/11, and I'm concerned that maybe we've lost focus about who perpetrated it and their ability to repeat those kinds of attacks, if not here or elsewhere, against our interests around the world, which they will do. And obviously, we saw the atrocities the Taliban committed, not only on their own people, but places that they invaded, like the Swat Valley. And those atrocities, I don't think the international community should tolerate.
Secretary Gates, he very visibly put General McChrystal in charge and took out General McKiernan. How do you think this reflects on Secretary Gates' leadership style?
Well, obviously, he's his own man. I mean, that's the fourth general he's seen out the door, if you think about it. And it means he's in charge. He is decisive. He knows the strategy that he wants. And if those in uniform can't implement that strategy, he's going to take measures to ensure it happens. So you want a secretary that's decisive. You want a secretary that has a clear-minded strategy for what he wants to do, and not just the military. I mean, Gates has said many things about the need to improve our other elements and agencies of government. To quote General Petraeus, we can't shoot our way to victory in these kinds of missions. You know, we need the State Department, USAID, and others on the ground. That is going to be the greatest measure of success, not just how many security forces we train or enemy we kill.
Thank you for joining us, General. That's retired General and former Commander-in-Chief of U.S. Central Command, Tony Zinni. He has a new book out called Leading the Charge, Leadership Lessons from the Battlefield to the Boardroom. So in talking with General Zinni, Lynn, there's really this question, how will we know that we're winning the war in Afghanistan?
Well, that's exactly the right question when you asked it. It's precisely what we need to know, because this is such a reflection on the Obama presidency. This is front and center of what the administration needs to fix, deal with. So we're all watching for that reason. And I have to tell you, though, it's for those of us who have covered American elections for so many years and participated in them, the whole concept of violence during an election and the idea that you are afraid to go to the polls, it's so foreign to us. I know we're used to reading about it and hearing about it in other countries, but don't you think that what a mindset there is that says you have to go to the polls?
It's incredible. And I remember when we first saw the Iraqis going to the polls, it brought tears to my eyes, frankly, to see. Do you remember the photos of the women, the video walking down the middle of the street with such courage and bravery to say, yeah, I'm going to cast my vote? It's something I guess we as Americans were so lucky that we don't have to, endure those conditions.
Well, tomorrow is the big day, and obviously we'll be getting those results when they start to come in. Meanwhile, Forbes magazine releases its list of the 100 most powerful women in the world later today. So who do you think belongs on that list? And do we actually still need a separate list of female moguls? We want to hear from you. Tell us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253. You know, you can catch the show live Monday through Friday. Thanks for listening. If you have any feedback or think there's any stories we should be covering on The Takeaway, contact us at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. See ya.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.